8:15 having arrived, I'm going to call the Education Finance Committee to order. And good morning, everyone. We do have a quorum, so we're going to start with the March 14th minutes. And Representative Moran, have you had a chance to look at those minutes?
I have.
Would you like to move those minutes?
So moved.
Representative Moran moves the March 14th, 2013 minutes for approval. Any discussion? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. All right. The first bill we have forward is House File 808. Representative Bernardi, would you like to move your bill? Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 808 to for possible consideration, the Omnibus Finance Bill.
Very good.
And I'd like to welcome my guests today. Come on and sit down. Okay, well, thank you for the opportunity to bring this before you today. This is an important workforce bill and helping create a strong workforce in Minnesota. For those of you that aren't familiar with adult basic education, funding was cut previously last year from a growth factor of 3% to 4%. And I just want to be clear that this is not funded like the per pupil student formula is in Minnesota. It's funded differently, and there's a formula factor, and our testifier, Tom, will talk to us about that today. Adult basic education ensures that low-income adults have viable options to attain the literacy and basic skills and credentials needed to connect to higher levels of education and better employment. Many ABE learners include new Americans and native-born Americans who have dropped out of school. The reduction that happened in funding makes it difficult for these initiatives across the state to not only meet the demand for services, but to be able to increase the intensity of service to meet the demands of our today's workforce. With us today, we have three testifiers. Tom Creighton Isom, representing the Literacy Action Network, will provide a brief overview of the ABE formula and describe the impact of the 1% reduction. Brent Olinger, manager, adult programs for Moundsview Public Schools, which is in my district, together with one of their adult learners, will give we'll share her name with you when she presents. And then we were going to have someone from Marshall today, but because of the weather and scheduling problems, she will not be able to join us, but she is very interested in this as well. So I would like to present to you, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I would like to ask all the testifiers to be as concise as possible. We've got four bills, and then we got a fifth one by Representative Radenovich, which I think is going to take a little bit longer. So I've kind of got a little bit of a time space for each of the bills. So please proceed and welcome.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Tom Citrin Heisum, and I serve as legislative chair for the Literacy Action Network, which is a statewide professional advocacy, professional development organization representing adult basic education. I have very brief remarks, so I will. I just want to talk for just a moment about adult basic ed and then for a moment about the funding formula so you understand what's at stake. Adult basic ed provides literacy and basic skills education for low-skilled adults in Minnesota to help them become self-sufficient and to participate effectively as workers, family members, and citizens. Last year, we served over 73,000 Minnesota adults. Of Minnesota's 3.3 million working-age adults, 60% have not completed college, and of those, over 251,000 have not completed high school, over 61,000 speak little or no English, and almost 350,000 earn less than a living wage, which is twice the federal poverty level. So our services are really crucial and essential in helping low-skilled Minnesota adults build the skills that they need to help support themselves and their families in a reasonable way and become part of the American dream. A word about the funding formula, so you understand a little bit about it. The formula was created in the year 2000, and it represents a compromise over how can we best serve Minnesotans in all parts of the state. There are factors in the formula which allow services in places originally the Twin Cities, but now many outstate areas as well, which are growing very quickly. as well as services in parts of greater Minnesota where there is very sparse population but still needs. So there are four parts of the formula. Those include basic population aid, so every part of the state gets some assistance, the number of adults over 20 without a high school diploma, and the number of K-12 students who have ELL students who don't speak English. So those things help determine basic funding levels. And then the majority of the formula is administered through what are called contact hours. And those are the hours of service the previous year divided into the available money, and that then funds the program. So it allows programs with very high need to grow over time. So when the formula was originally developed, there was an 8% growth factor that was decreased several years ago to 3%, and we were able to kind of maintain at that. And then 2 years ago, it was decreased further to 2%, and that is really starting to now and in the future create some real problems for our service providers. The current contact hour rate this year is $8.63 an hour, and that's exactly the same as it was 9 years previously. You know, over that period of time, the inflation rate has totaled about 20%, so the amount of services we're able to provide per dollar is going down, as it does for all sorts of services. So we're beginning to get really concerned. We also anticipate that if federal immigration reform goes forward, as we assume it may well happen, the demand for services is really going to skyrocket, because there will be so many new Americans who will need to learn English to get on the road to citizenship and so on. So I also want to mention that our contact hours have reached a record high of almost 6 million hours last year, which is a 44% increase over 10 years. So restoring the growth factor to 3% is crucial to programs being able to ensure that we can address the demand for workforce preparation, as well as to support learners into as they progress into higher education. I'd like to turn now over to Brent Ullinger and one of his students, Hayet Bandomi, who will speak briefly about her experience with adult basic education. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please introduce yourself.
Hello. Oh, please, go ahead.
No. Hello, everyone. My name is Hayet Bandomi. I have been in Mountain View Basic Adult Education for 3 years now. My English is getting better. Every time I go in a class, I'm so happy to be there. If I didn't have that school, I would be staying home, maybe wondering how to speak with people outside. So it is a very good place to achieve my goals. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Brent Ullinger. I'll be very brief. Adult education in Mounds View Schools has been very fortunate over the past number of years to increase services that we provide for our students, to provide child care for our students. Hyatt is a perfect example of that, and these increasing demands on resources are sort of, we're kind of hitting the upper limit there. Where we're looking at how do we access some additional funds to continue those resources, and increasing this growth factor back to 3% will enable us to maintain what services we're offering and hopefully to increase some technology in the classroom, smart boards in each classroom and that sort of thing. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Do we have some questions for the testifiers? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bernardi or any of the other testifiers, is there a recent report on adult basic education activities so that we know how many are enrolled across the state, what the costs have been, and what the results have been, so we can, you know, attest to the good work that our testifier has
Mr.
mentioned.
Citron Heisel.
Mr. Chair, committee, Representative Erickson, committee members, yes, there are two different sources of information. Each year, the State Department of Education Adult Basic Ed staff produces about a two-page report that summarizes all of the services and costs for the previous year. We also have a much more extensive ABE impact report, which we update every other year. This is not the year we update it. We updated it last year. And we could certainly get copies of either or both of those reports for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that would be good for us.
Thank you very much, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure which one of the testifiers. Analyzing the fiscal note, I'm seeing that there's year-to-year growth of 126, then 58, then 39, but basically it's about a half million each time and going up. what assumptions are made for closing the graduation within on-time graduation problem we have, and then improving our graduation rate, which I assume would actually cause a decrease in the need for this, which is would be good all around. But I'm trying to understand these increases in this program, because you know basically if we were steady state, then I would assume that this would be a little bit more steady state, and I really hope that we're improving in our grad rate. If we have an idea of what's contributing to this fiscal note.
Mr. Ellinger?
Mr. Chairman, I think Moundsview Adult Education is a prime example of why funding is going up statewide. You're right, about $500,000 a biennium or a year?
Per year.
Per year. And really the reason for that is increased immigration, increased need for services. In Moundsview, we've been growing. We've been serving about 20% more students each of the last about 8 years. And you know, when you're serving 400 students, you know, your costs are pretty known. If you know the next year you're going to serve 480, and the year after, you know, 600, and now we're serving 800 students each year. You know, the additional revenue is necessary to hire additional teachers, to pay for additional classroom space, and those sorts of needs.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping Mr. Strom could enlighten us into what is the enrollment growth that we're having and projecting, because I assume that went into this calculation and would go with the testifier. And then I'd like to understand what proportionality of adult and immigration, because you know then we could have an understanding as the testifier gave that it's not just because we aren't graduating our students that we have this increase.
Mr. Strom, do you have some of that information?
Mr. Chair, in the budget books, they're beginning on page 223 of the budget book is a summary of the adult basic education program, and they've got a few of the details that Representative Quam is asking about on those pages. On page 224, they show the number of clients who entered post-secondary, the number who left public assistance, the number of ABE clients who gained or bettered employment, and the number of clients who are better able to assist their children in school. There's not the raw data that Representative Quam's asking about, number of participants and contact hours increasing over time, and we'll get that from the department for him. The department does keep track of that because, as the testifier said, the formula is fairly involved, and one part of that keys off of the number of contact hours in each adult basic program. So they do track the number of hours of service provided, and they can show essentially how that's changed over time. So, Mr. Chair, we'll get those details for Representative Quam.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the young lady testifying, I want to commend you on the amount of English that you've learned, and you seem to be doing very well. Could you just speak very briefly, if you would, as to what your level of understanding or comprehension was as an immigrant coming here, what the expectation was that you would need to know English in coming here?
Ms. Bodomi?
Yes. I had a very tough time when I came here. I didn't really understand people talking, didn't understand words that I would understand if it's written, I would understand. The school helped me with the spelling, with the reading, and even with talking. Like when you say a word, how you will hear it from American people, How would you listen to it? How would you say it again, even if it's not a word that you use every day? It helped me increase my English, and every time I take a new class, everybody, my surrounder, knows that I am improving. I have taken the advanced class for English, and after that I went to GED, and we had a new class with teacher Erica that gives us English for academic purposes, which was so helpful. So I choose to do that so I can increase my ability of understanding English and talking, so I can take GED or and high school diploma, so I would have better understanding for the exercises and everything.
Mr. Representative Hurtas.
Thank you, and you certainly have demonstrated as to how the program has been good for you, but I was more curious as to what your level of understanding was before you made the decision to come to America, how important it was to be able to speak English, or if you had perhaps thought that you would be able to assimilate with other folks that spoke your own language, if there was going to be some type of support system to communicate and assimilate into our population.
I knew that I would have problems, and because my husband is a U.S. citizen, so he was trying to talk with me, and they couldn't understand anything. So I went to Brent, and they was just talking like, I don't know his language, and he doesn't know mine. And I went through it, like, from zero to where I am now.
Very good. Thank you. You've done a great job.
Is there anyone here in the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 808? If not, Representative Bernardi, any closing comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you, members. Tim Strom was talking about some of the outcomes of the program, and just an anecdotal one. My daughter is volunteering at an ABE program, and she postponed taking her math class, and so she had to do had to test in for that. And so the ABE helped her be able to advance in passing that and being able to start out in statistics and skip her first class. So it also helped my daughter, which was very helpful. So anyway, it's been a positive experience for her, and we really appreciate everyone in our community that's helping all of our community members be able to achieve their dreams and be able to help our economy and make us the best state in the nation for workforce. So, and that's one of our goals of this committee, so I appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Bernardi renews her motion to lay over House File 808 for possible inclusion. Thank you so much for testifying this morning. Thank you. Next, we have House File 1407. Representative Ann Zelk. Representative Ann Zelk, good morning, and would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members. I'd move 1407. I do have an author's amendment.
Very good. Why don't you move that also at this
time? Okay. I would move the A1 amendment.
All right.
Simply strikes.
This is to get it into the form you would like.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we've got a
get the
representative
bill in the form that I would prefer. On page 2, line 6, strike the word must and insert the word may.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Ansel. We have a motion, amendment A1. Any debate on that amendment? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Please proceed, Representative Ansel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to apologize for the raspiness of my voice. Having kind of a tough week here, as many of you are. This legislation involves transportation and the manner in which schools report transportation costs for reimbursement to the department. The genesis of it goes back to the 1995 legislative session. I don't believe hardly any of us were here then in the capacity of being on this committee, that's for sure. But a change was made then that this legislation remedies This bill was brought to me by the Equity in Education folks, and Mr. Lundell is here.
Mr. Chair, this is
Mr. Lundell.
Mr. Chair, this is on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Pupil Transportation. And I think also the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association, Mr. Kelleher, who's not here, but they're also, I can't speak that he's supporting the bill, but they've been involved, and then also MASBO, the business officials.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Ansel's laid out the framework quite well. There were some changes made in the, also that added to those changes that were made, I believe, in 2010. That limited the way that school districts could report certain transportation expenditures to the state and how those would be allocated. Dave Peterson is with me this morning. He's the chair of the Minnesota Association for Pupil Transportation Legislative Committee. He's also very involved in the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. We're a little bit surprised this morning to see a fiscal note from the Department of Education, and my only comment to that is that there's costs in the way it's being done now, and those costs are being borne by local school districts in more time figuring out how to report. And so as we balance the needs here, we have to remember that the department may need some help, but local districts also need help. Because this is something that's become very, very complicated, and we certainly want to make sure that there's an expedited process at the local level to make sure that things are done accurately, but also done without undue complication. Thank you. And now I'll turn it over to Mr. Peterson.
Very good. Mr. Peterson, welcome.
Good morning. My name is David Peterson. I'm a communications officer with the Minnesota Association for Pupil Transportation. And before I forget, I want to also mention I'm on the MASBO Business Managers Association Committee, and MASBO supports this bill. Just a minute or two for a little more background. The Department of Education made a couple changes in transportation reporting to deal with some inequities that were going on. One is some districts were charging indirect costs, since it's part of the superintendent's salary, to transportation budget to trying to get some of these special transportation reimbursement revenue. So one change was to just allow direct costs for transportation fund. Another change was to go away from actual contract rates and make everybody use a cost allocation method. Initially, there was three methods, a cost per mile, a cost per hour, or a cost per route. For the effective for the 2011 fiscal year, it was limited down to just one basis, a cost per mile, because otherwise some districts would run the numbers three different ways and take the highest one. Unfortunately, currently the cost per mile is not probably the best method for measuring transportation costs, but maybe the cost per hour is the best method. And this kind of bears out in that most districts have a contract, had the contract written on a cost per hour basis. So this bill would go back to what existed in law prior to fiscal 2006 and allow actual contract rates to be used for calculating the transportation allocation. And one other thing to point out is this, it would just be an option, it would not be a requirement upon districts. I think that's all I had to say in answer to questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the testifier, Representative Angzell? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm not sure who should answer this question, but is this actually going to simplify the way contracted services communicate with the school district? Because I notice here that there's some differences in special education, and that a database would have to be created to collect this data. So maybe the person from the school buses could comment on that.
Mr. Peterson.
The problem comes into play in that special transportation service for special education students and other special unique situations is pretty well funded under the special ed funding formula. And so the question arises, what's the cost for special transportation? And there's been incentive for districts to try and charge extra money to that category, and departments trying to make sure everyone is being fair. And we feel that right now it's not the most equitable way of allocating costs to the special ed transportation category.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. That's very helpful. I think I understand better what this proposal might be trying to do in that regard and what the department's doing. But you made a comment about it would be better to charge cost per hour. Could you comment more on that? Because I think the proposal is whatever is reasonable, and is it one or the other or the other? Is it cost per mile, cost per per hour, or cost per route, or cost per student basis? Which of those would prevail, or do all four of them have to be considered?
Mr. Peterson.
Prior to 2006 school year, districts that owned their own buses would typically use a cost per mile basis because okay. it's most simple method of mm-hmm. tracking costs, whereas districts that contracted with private bus companies would use the extra contract rates. The extra contract rates became a problem because some districts would manipulate the rates to get extra money into the special ed funding. For example, a field trip that might be worth $125, some districts would have their contracts set up to charge $1 for the field trip and throw extra $124 into the special ed funding form category. So that's the basis of a need for controlling the cost going in the special ed category. The cost per hour is probably, I say that's probably the best basis because most districts, when they have contracts, private companies use the cost per hour basis. Transportation has a substantial fixed cost for bus garage, administration, vehicles, and the variable cost, fuel and driver's wages is quite substantial, so contracts are generally written on a cost per hour basis starting with a minimum amount of payment. So I think ideal to our associations would be to allow cost per mile for those districts that want to use the simple record keeping, mm-hmm. but also allow cost per hour to have the most accurate cost available. And we're proposing to go back to allowing a extra contract rate, which would be even the more ideal, is using extra contract rates is the most accurate cost for reporting transportation.
Representative Ansel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Erickson, your questions are very appropriate and right on. Several superintendents from throughout the state have contacted me regarding the intent of this bill, and in the course of conversation, superintendents have said the current process, the current procedure is overly complicated, is being administered in a patchwork quilt of ways, is not very user-friendly to school districts, treats districts that operate their own buses as opposed to contracting for bus services differently. And as an aside, in my conversations with school superintendents, several of them said, you can expect the department to give you a fiscal note that is quite large, and that, of course, is what's happened. And I must say, as the author of the bill, I find it a little peculiar that we would get the fiscal note at 4:39 p.m. the day before the bill is scheduled to be heard. That's troubling to me. And that tells me that this is probably a good piece of legislation. A bill that your local school districts, especially rural districts, would probably be very, very supportive of.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience that'd like to testify for or against 1407? Please come forward. Please state your. Please proceed. And please state your name for the committee.
Yes, Chair. My name is Rick Heller. Unofficially represented the print disabled and twice exceptional. As you all know, you'll find twice exceptional in the Governor Bill 1151 on page 11 and 12 now. I'm here to speak about how I make data requests from districts regarding a whole child school file. Never did I ever see the school records on bus transportation. Okay. And because the changes this to a May would not allow me to know that my kids get an appropriate services for special education, according to this overview, which is yet fully accessible in a PDF format online, it mentions special education, so that's why I came up here. The twice exceptional learners are special ed students that are gifted, and the print disabled are those that are at risk or never been identified because they never became eligible. I would based on turning something from a must to a may, I think is really not the answer here. I propose perhaps someone could amend this orally that the Department of Education would create a standardized data form that bus companies are required to fill out so it can interface truly with the Department of Education, because as a representative here had mentioned, it's a hodgepodge. And to straighten that up, frankly, it would, if you require those who bid on these contracts that they make their, first of all, the materials fully electronic, accessible with readers, which is, as you all know, is text-to-speech. And also, one of the big issues I've noticed in interagencies, even those are outside of it, that are contractors, they need to really align themselves with our new current statute in 16, which talks about accessibility for requirements for all state agencies, with exemption of the Capitol and the Governor's House. So that's my suggestion. Create a standard form that when they apply again for bidding on with school districts, because you'll know for sure that right away the districts will go with the may. They'll never go with the shall. And if the whole thing about special education is for parents to track about if their kids are getting service, especially if they're over the age of 18, and then they're not allowed access in a meaningful like conversation, because the student isn't yet there yet as far as advocating for themselves. It's hard for a parent to know, frankly, without that data in front of them, that they're getting appropriate services. I'm currently one of those parents. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. I'm going to like to call on Department of Education if someone would come down, and then we're going to go back to Mr. Anzelk for final comment, or Representative Anzelk for final comments, and we'll. But just to get the department's view on this, I don't know who wants the Dr. Melcher, Mr. McHenry. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Tom Melcher. I'm the finance director at the Department of Education. Our department prepared the fiscal note for this bill, as we do for all bills in the education area. I don't think there's anything different about this bill in terms of other bills. We do make an effort to get the fiscal notes completed before the bills are heard, and it's not uncommon for us to get the fiscal note done the afternoon before or the morning of the hearing. So typically we're given 5 days to do the fiscal notes. They come up to us from the Department of Management and Budget, and we try to do those as quickly as we can using reasonable assumptions about the cost and what's happening. in transportation since the mid-90s, we've had a kind of a challenging circumstance as it relates to transportation reporting because our special education funding is based on a reimbursement of cost. Theoretically, we reimburse 100% of the cost of special education transportation, except for the proration that occurs because of the cap. And for the remainder of the transportation, there essentially is no direct reimbursement based on cost because the funding comes to school districts on a per pupil rate that is generated based on the number of students that are enrolled in the school districts, not even the number that are transported. So from a school district's perspective, if they want to maximize their revenue, they should try to get as much money in the in the special education category as they can, and that involves doing their accounting in a way that will maximize their revenue. When the law was changed back in the mid-90s to this kind of a process, we do have auditors that go out and do 25 audits a year, and we found a number of cases where school districts had kind of allocated more cost into the special education transportation category as opposed to other categories than you would expect if they used some kind of standard cost allocation methodology. And there were cases where contractors would, especially if the contractor was doing the bidding on both regular and special education transportation, there might be a kind of an informal agreement where the cost of regular transportation was a little lower than you might expect it to be, and the cost of special education transportation was a little higher, and that resulted in more special education aid being paid to the school district. Now, there isn't a net increase statewide because we do cap special education aid, but when there are changes made that allow a little more creativity in terms of the cost allocation process, what it does is it increases the special education transportation cost, which then creates a lower proration factor so that the ultimate bottom line is that unless there are some kinds of practices in place to make sure that things are reasonable, that you do have a lower percentage being reimbursed on teacher salaries. So the trade-off becomes higher percentage reimbursement on special transportation and a lower percentage reimbursement on teacher salaries. So, you know, the language in this bill seems very reasonable. We're just going to the district contracts for transportation, instead of using a standard cost allocation procedure, we use whatever the contract cost was, unless there's some determination by the department that the allocations are somewhat unreasonable. And then the issue gets to be, does the legislature intend in creating legislation of this type for the department to take that responsibility seriously and to collect data that would be necessary to evaluate the cost allocation practices of the district and to then make determinations as called for in the bill. If that information is not intended to be something the department would need to actually follow through on, collect the data, do the analysis, have meetings with school districts to determine the reasonableness of the cost and so forth, then we wouldn't have to worry about the cost. But then you probably could expect that the cost of special education would go up and we'll have a lower proration factor. So I guess that's kind of the background, Mr. Chair, that I'd like to share.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? Okay, all right. Thank you so much. I'm going to call on Representative Anzelk for closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for your patience and for hearing the bill. As most issues in this committee, this is more complicated than originally meets the eye. But I can't resist the opportunity to say to you that if you believe in a system of public education that is locally administered and delivered with state supervision and direction and technical assistance, then this bill is a good idea. This is the direction that we should go. The role of the department is to provide level, even, steady technical assistance and guidance and supervision to districts so that districts can deliver, whether it's transportation or any other service that local school boards deliver to children, is delivered on a fair and equitable basis. So thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much. And Representative Angzelt renews his motion to lay over House File 1407 as amended for possible inclusion into the omnibus report. Thank you so much. We are now going to move to House File 1141. Representative Moran. Representative Moran, if you could move your bill, please.
Yes, I would like to move House File 1141.
You laid over for possible inclusion. Very good. Please proceed.
So, good morning, Chair and members. I'd like to thank the Chair for allowing this bill to be heard this morning in your committee or our committee. So, I am bringing this bill for, one, because we've had an opportunity to really learn a lot about the importance of investing in early childhood education. We've had the opportunity to hear and learn about ACEs, the Adverse Childhood Experiences. We also have learned that 90% of the brain is developed by five. So here before you is a population that we would like to include in the opportunity to be in an early childhood education setting. I was a part of a work group called the Invisible Child Work Group, which was worked with homeless families. And what we know about homeless families and mothers is that when you're homeless, the goal is to find housing for that family. So a lot what we do not recognize is that when families are looking for housing, there are children who are involved, and a lot of times there are small children who are involved in traveling with the parent as the parent look for housing. And it is our belief that these children are sometimes what we would call invisible. We don't see them. We want to make them visible. We want them to have access to quality care and opportunity to grow and develop so that they can be successful entering kindergarten, you know, reading by third grade. And in that term, not only successful in school, but successful in life. And so to explain the bill in more depth, I have a testifier here, Alexandra Fitzsimmons, who I would like to really explain the bill in more depth.
Welcome, Ms. Fitzsimmons. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. CDF advocates for policies statewide that seek to improve the well-being of children, especially children who are at risk for developmental delay and poor outcomes. And I do want to say a special thank you to Representative Moran, who has truly been a champion of trying to make infants and toddlers and young children who are homeless more visible and look at what we can do with our programs and services that are already existing to make certain that they're on the right track to healthy development. Research and practice experience have shown that homelessness is one of the most traumatic experiences a young child can face. In addition to the lack of a stable place to live, homeless children may also be living in deep poverty and be part of a family who is fleeing domestic violence. Homeless infants and toddlers are much more likely than stably housed children to exhibit developmental delays. According to a recent national study, half, 54%, of homeless preschoolers had a major developmental delay in language, gross motor, fine motor, or social, and delays in more than one area. This is compared with only 16% of their stably housed peers. Many researchers report significant relationships among the experience of homelessness, higher incidence of childhood illness, and developmental delay. These problems are demonstrably greater for children who are homeless than for stably housed children living in poverty. And since Dr. Ann Mattson is going to be talking about the brain development piece and what we know about the experiences of children who are homeless, let me get into the bill itself and what it does. And so what this bill does is it ensures that children who are homeless, so infants and toddlers 0 to 3, have access to Part C, which is also called early intervention, and it's also called Help Me Grow in Minnesota. And Part C, which comes under the IDEA, was created in 1986 to do three things. First, to enhance the development of infants and toddlers with disabilities. Second, to minimize potential developmental delay. And third, to reduce educational costs by reducing the need for special ed services as children with disabilities reach school age. So Part C services are provided by the school districts. The services include speech and language therapy, nutrition, physical therapy, and family counseling. And these services are focused on helping babies and toddlers learn the skills children typically develop during the first 3 years of life. So crawling, walking, talking, playing, dressing, eating, all of those things that we want our children to be able to do successfully. And Part C is voluntary, and it delivers services using a two-generational approach. So mom and dad are taught, just by way of example, if a child is experiencing gross motor delay, mom or dad would be taught exercises that could be used in daily routine, so in diaper changing, during tummy time, during that interaction. So things that can be used every day that mom and dad, that the caregiver is doing then with the child. And the other great thing about Part C is that it offers a holistic approach. So a family coordinator helps families develop what's called an individualized service plan and identify other potential services that the child may benefit from. So currently in Minnesota, Part C provides early intervention services to infants and toddlers who are exhibiting a developmental delay or have a medical condition likely to lead to developmental delay, so fetal alcohol syndrome, Down syndrome. And so what we would do is we would open that up, Part C, and say, by the fact that a child is homeless and they've experienced homelessness, and we know how traumatic that is, that they would also then be categorically eligible for these Part C early intervention services. And we know, again, that high-quality early intervention services can change the trajectory of a child's life. There was a study that was done in 2009, a MinLink study, that followed children over time who had received early intervention services and found that one-third of those children didn't need special education by second or third grade. So one-third. Ensuring the healthy development of infants and toddlers experiencing homelessness is an urgent task that should be considered within the early childhood school readiness continuum. So I encourage you to support this bill and ensure that homeless infants and toddlers have access to the services they need that puts them on the right track to school success.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzsimmons.
Thank you.
Dr. Mastin.
good morning. I'm Ann Mastin. I'm a professor at the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota, and I'm very honored to be here today to testify in relation to this bill. I have conducted research for a long time with these families and young children, and our earliest research, both here and in other states across the country, documented high levels of academic, health, and behavioral problems in these children. And that's not surprising, as you've heard, given the extremely high risk level you find in these families. The children often have multiple risk factors that we know are associated with poor academic achievement, poor brain development, and other health problems. Many homeless children in these families are very young. About half in most populations are in that 0 to 5 age range. And early in life, during sensitive periods for brain development, these children often experience what scientists now call toxic stress. And it's called that because of the harm this kind of stress can cause to the developing child. Today I want to highlight findings from our recent research because it strongly suggests a need for educational services for very young homeless children. I do have a handout for you which summarizes what I'm saying with more detail and also has the citations and graphs that illustrate what I'm going to say now. Two of our recent papers, which were published in October and December, report on analyses of test scores conducted in collaboration with Minneapolis Public School District, which does a wonderful job of testing children year over year, so that you can track academic achievement on a standardized national norm reference test over time. So these data report on tests done from over a five-year period from 2005 to 2009 each fall, and the data are compelling because the test is designed to measure learning over time within individual children. And the results of these analyses of over 26,000 children attending and tested during that window show that homeless, highly mobile students have significantly lower academic achievement than children qualified for free meals, who, of course, are living in poverty within 130% of the poverty level, so even greater risk than other low-income children. When you take a look at this handout, on the last page I have a graph showing the achievement gaps for reading. And if you look at it, you will see that the homeless students start off low, averaging about the 12th percentile on a national test, and the gaps between groups never close. In other words, the achievement gap that you see is very persistent. The achievement gaps for math are very similar, but they widen over grade level. Gaps like this are also already evident if we look earlier in the school years. We published a paper in December showing similar gaps in first grade reading scores, showing that homeless, highly mobile children are significantly lower in first grade reading scores than even children who are qualified for free lunch. But not all children are struggling. If you look at the other figure provided in the graphs of the handout, you'll see that individual learning scores for homeless, highly mobile children are shown, and you can see incredible variation within individual children. Some homeless children do well. Close to half of them manage to stay at the average level or better over time. But of course, many do not. We also know from our research that early reading scores and test scores in kindergarten and first grade predict later academic achievement on the benchmarks we're all concerned about. We also have published findings from assessments done with preschoolers tested while they were residing in emergency shelters in the Twin Cities. Some of these children are ready for kindergarten, but many are not ready. In our studies, we've been focusing our work on a set of cognitive skills related to brain development, and you may have heard about this because there's a lot of research in the press about this, called executive functions. These are the self-control skills that are required for paying attention, listening, waiting your turn, and in general for learning and school readiness. Kindergarten teachers love children to be ready in this way. These skills predict early school success. But unfortunately, many of the children we meet in emergency shelters and test have very poor executive function skills. There's good evidence from other research around the country that these skills can be harmed by high levels of stress in early development, the kind of stress that many homeless, highly mobile children have already experienced. But the good news is that these skills can be learned and taught. In the course of our research, we meet many homeless young children who have fallen far behind. Their parents want very much for them to succeed in school. The children have missed out on interventions they needed, often because of the family stress and their mobility. Early childhood is a crucial window of opportunity for these children to intervene when specialized education services could have a powerful effect on their school readiness. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Moran, do you have other testifiers?
I think there's one other testifier.
Okay.
Maybe two.
Okay. Representative Moran, two testifiers? Okay. Thank you very much. If you would introduce yourself and welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Sharon Henry Blythe. I am the director of the Visible Child Initiative with the Family Housing Fund.
Welcome.
I want to express my sincere thanks to Representative Moran for stepping forward and taking leadership on behalf of homeless children, and my colleagues at the Children's Defense Fund for the leadership that they've demonstrated. As you've heard, conditions that accompany homelessness are often experience exposure to domestic violence, community violence, poverty, poor nutrition. These things have an impact on children's development. In 2009, I published a research project, a very, very small research project that I did in my work to begin to understand the status of homeless young children. And in that research project, I interviewed 185 families and 395 staff. We learned a lot. It was called the Infant Toddler Discovery Project. We learned quite a bit from that research. But I will talk about one finding that we had through that research. We used a tool called the Home Tool. The Home Tool is designed to understand the degree to which the home environment supports a child's development, a young child's development. What we found was, out of those 185 families, the infants and toddlers, about one-third, were living in home environments that did not support their development. By the time that we looked at the 3 to 5 year olds, it jumped to two-thirds. And this confirmed to us our theory that risk escalates with age. Starting early with children that have experienced had the experiences of trauma that homeless children have had is important to start with, start at a very young age. As was suggested, as was mentioned, early intervention services have a strong likelihood to reduce special education costs, and it is a two-generation support. So parents learn how to support their children's development. I'll tell a little story and then I'll end.
There you go.
I've said this in other testimony. In my interview, when I was doing the Infant Toddler Discovery Project, there was one mom that I interviewed, and we were looking at her four-year-old. She had three children, all under the age of five. For the purposes of the research, we were looking specifically at the four-year-old. And at some point in the interview, I asked about how he was doing, and she said, well, he used to bump his head up against the wall all the time, but he doesn't do that so much anymore. By this time, this child was 4 years old. This mom had moved from north to south to suburb to city, and at no point in that child's life, and had been homeless his entire 4 years, at no point in his life had it been identified that this child was in need of support for his social emotional development. I wish I knew where he was right now, but I don't. The Part C Early Intervention Services is an opportunity for us, for you, to begin to begin to reduce generational homelessness by supporting the healthy development of very young children.
Thank you very much. Representative Plum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do agree that we need, you know, support and programs and assistance. I would hope for a better way of doing it other than the way this bill does. It basically makes every child under age three that is homeless be classified as being having a disability. And I'd rather approach it as we have these resources that go and help the homeless. Because, you know, reading through the language here, I don't think there's a physical or medical condition that is guaranteed by being homeless. I think what it is that we need to address the needs, and I think even to a greater degree, be able to assess what the needs are for the individuals and help them. The intent I totally agree with, but I really don't like saying because you don't have, you're homeless, that you are disabled. Because I know examples of people who have been homeless and have, well, there's a lady that wrote a book about her experience. She went to Harvard and was accepted. But she had, assistance, and she plugged into the programs. I don't want to have that connotation because of circumstances. So I agree with the intent, and I agree that we need to look at ways to make sure that they aren't overlooked or missed, because we have a lot of great programs, as was testified today. They're available. We need that connectivity to those resources and programs and that, identification. But, frankly, I don't think that the verbiage change in this bill is the appropriate way to do it.
Thank you. Representative Myra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moran, I'm looking at line 2.20 and 2.21. It talks about the word homelessness and homelessness as defined by the United States Department of Education. Could you please give me that definition, and is there a reference where a person can look that up?
Representative Moran?
2.0, 2.1?
Yeah, line 2.20 and 2.21.
Yes, that's correct. It's page 2, line 2.20 for 20 and 2.21.
So, yeah, we're looking for, is there a definition by the United States Department of Education of homelessness? And please state your name, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcy Jeffries, and I'm with the Children's Defense Fund, and that is defined by the federal government. And it includes, of course, children without an abode, children living in a car, unstably housed, doubled up. It's defined in more detail by the federal government.
Would someone be able to provide this committee with that definition, please? Okay, very good.
Mr. Chair, I would really appreciate, Mr. Chair, I'd really appreciate also a reference where the public could look that up as well. Thank you.
We will do that also. Very good. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Moran, I really appreciate what you're doing bringing this forward, but I have some serious reservations about it. And somewhat following on, Representative Quam said, you know, this is an expensive program. It's about $12 million the first year and then $15, $16 million following that. And it seems to me that we need to get at the root issue, which is a lack of housing. That we have to have affordable housing and places for people to go so that they're not homeless and not in this situation. That's one part of the issue I have with this. The second part, it has to do with we're going from diagnosing something to identifying, and we can further expand that to, say, single-parent families, or we can expand it to families that are in poverty. And I'm just very worried about continuing to expand special education at a time when it's not being funded either by the state or the federal government. And we, you know, $12 million, the state doesn't have that money to put into special ed. That means it comes out of our general funds of the school district, which means the class sizes get bigger and all students are going to suffer. So I would much rather see this go to housing and to Health and Human Services than be a special education issue.
Thank Representative you. Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. When it's appropriate, I'd like the department to explain the fiscal note, please.
Oh, okay, we're out of time for questions here. So what I'm going to do is ask the department as they make their way down, is there anyone here for or against that would like to testify, for or against House File 1141? Please come forward. Mr. Heller, please come forward.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
Quick. First, I would like to respond to the question around the root cause of bin housing. And we know that there are extremely a lot of people, individuals and families who are homeless. And that was the point of the bill, because as family are homeless, they are children who are also homeless who are seen as invisible, because the focus is on housing, but that child is still developing, their brain is still developing, or lack of those triggers that are impacting that family and that child is really delaying development. So the goal is, as families are homeless and without housing, that we are supporting the child, we are making that child a priority, because we know the importance of investing early. If we're not funding it, we need to be funding it, because we know there's a huge saving if we do it on the front end. We pay for it on the back end. So, yes, there's a note, but if we don't pay for it early, we will pay for it later.
Okay, Mr. Heller, I'm going to please ask you to be very concise.
Thank you, Chair and members of the policy, education policy member. I suggest perhaps look at the Bruce Vennell homeless bill, perhaps. I don't know who's knowledgeable about that, but anybody that was speaking today perhaps are, and how that interfaces with that safety net that was originally intended as it relates to that. And is this superseding that, and if so, maybe it's needed. Thank you for your considerations.
Thank you very much. I could ask someone from the department to come down to go through the fiscal note. Dr. Melcher. And then we're going to go to Representative Moran for final thoughts. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Melcher, Department of Education. The fiscal note cost is generated based on the increase in average daily membership for students that would be eligible to be counted in the pre-kindergarten disabled category. So students that are preschoolers are eligible to be counted as part of the general education revenue. They generate a minimum of 28/100ths of an ADM if they are go through the process. On the average, students in this category that are birth to four are generating 0.316, so just a little bit over the minimum amount of average daily membership. And so the fiscal note is based on the number of students who are homeless, which is about 1.5% of the first and second graders, and applying that percentage against the pre-kindergarten population to identify the number of students who would be eligible. We estimate that there would be about 1,700 additional average daily membership being counted by school districts based on this kind of 0.3 of a full-time equivalent multiplied by the number of students that would be eligible. And then we essentially apply that additional average daily membership to the general education formula rate to generate the additional amount of general education aid. And then in the special education area, we do not look at what the cost is of serving these students. That is based simply on the growth in the average daily membership, which increases the cap. The cap for special education is based on the cap in the prior year, adjusted for change in ADM, and then we also apply a 4% inflation rate. So we haven't looked at what it would actually cost to fully fund this education. We've simply looked at how much would the cap go up for special education as a result of the additional average daily membership being added to the program. And then because average daily membership would go up, there would be some impact on school district referendum levies, because that's based on the number of pupil units in a school district. And as a result of that, there would be a small property tax shift adjustment, and we factor that in as well. So that's kind of an overview of the fiscal note, and I just want to stress that it's not based on what we think the cost would be of fully paying for these services. It's simply how would this affect average daily membership, and then through the general education formula, applying the gen ed rate, and then also the special education formula, simply applying the average daily membership and how that affects the cap.
Thank you, Dr. Melcher. Thank you. And Representative Moran, final thoughts.
So, again, you know, I just want to make a few points, is that it is highly unlikely that all homeless children would be identified, referred to accept Part C. It does not identify the cost savings this year that will occur to the state and school districts due to intervening early. It really reduces the cost by meeting a more stringent definition of homeless, you know, shelter transitional housing. And we must keep in mind, under our current EC system, there are a few options for these children who we know are at high risk. You know, EAC is underfunded. There truly is not enough slots. CC assistance is only for employed parents and feasible only if they are on a regular work schedule. Let's look to how we can really support all our kids who we know are at high risk. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Representative Moran, renews her motion to lay over House File 1141 for possible consideration into the omnibus bill. Thank you so much. We will move to House File 1406. Representative Radenovich, if you would move your bill, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I move House File 1406 for possible inclusion.
Please proceed.
Okay. This bill, 1406, is Education Advancement Revenue. It's called the EAR Bill. And the way it works, I'm going to just kind of give a very rough overview of how it works, and I'll probably defer to Mr. Strom to kind of get into the details a little bit more. But it addresses, you know, one concern to an extent in education funding, which is disparity in property tax wealth, district to district, and the inability of some districts to pass a levy because of that. This bill, in effect, would not decrease revenue for any school district across the state of Minnesota, but would increase revenue for 54 of the lowest funded referendum districts across the state of Minnesota. And so many of those districts are in, you know, my area, in northern Minnesota and greater Minnesota, and it's important to them. And so there will be some testifiers testifying in support of this bill and perhaps in opposition too, I'm not sure. But at this point, I think I'll defer to Mr. Strom to kind of go through the details of how the financing works here. But in effect, it substitutes $300 for property tax levy with a mix of aid and levy from the state.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, members, I know you're very short on time. There's a printout that's being handed out that may be the easiest way to understand Representative Rodinovich's bill and the effects of that bill. What this printout shows is the current amount of referendum per pupil in the fourth column from the left. You can see the and this is the amount after the subtraction, essentially. And then the amount of the new year revenue in the three columns labeled House File 1406, Revenue Levy and Aid. And you can see that this provision would create $290 million of this new category of revenue. Roughly $100 million of that is aid, and $181 million is levy. The referendum is then offset against that for the $300, and the net effect in the seventh to last column is a $16 million increase for those 54 school districts. The rest of the districts have no change in their revenue. And then there's a levy and aid change going on. Because the levy is at a lower level, there's $135 million of levy reduction provided across the state, $151 million of aid increase. And the net effect is shown on a sample hypothetical property on the last four columns. And basically what happens is, depending on the class of property, there's going to be a change because the tax base is switching from market value to tax capacity. And in the interest of time, the important points, I think, are the $16 million revenue increase for 54 school districts, all other districts the same on a revenue basis. Most districts will experience a decrease in levy. A few districts that don't have a referendum, or that do have a referendum, rather, will have a slight increase in levy because of their difference in tax base on tax capacity compared to market value. And then those districts that get the new revenue, many of those districts will also have a levy increase. And you can see that the levy that's raised is the amount that will essentially provide a uniform rate in the second-to-last column there. And on a sample property, you can see that uniform rate turns out to be about $18 on a $100,000 taxable market value property. And, Mr. Chair, I know we're terribly short of time, so.
Very good.
Thank
you very much, Mr. Strom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand there's some testifiers here that would like to testify in support of the bill.
You bet. If they would please come forward. Representative Rodinovich, how many testifiers do you have?
I think we've got a few different groups.
Do you have?
I think we've got a few different groups here, but we'll keep them very, very brief.
Okay. So,
well, and Sam, as we probably will.
Very good.
Mr. Chairman, proceed. And members, Sam Wallace at the Minnesota Rural Education Association. I kind of jumped to the stand here to keep things moving.
Very good.
I'll try and be brief. What's being handed out to you is a map that I want to show that illustrates to the committee who exactly we're talking about trying to help here with this bill. The darker brown districts, I'll give one to Representative Rodinovich, are the districts on the map that currently have less than $300 per pupil in operating referendum authority. Mr. Chairman and members, the operating referendum has really driven adequacy for a lot of districts in the system, but also a growing inequity in the system. The 5th to 95th gap for general education funding has now grown to a disparity of 31%. Compared to about 18% a decade ago. This bill, we believe, will drive that down about 22% to a 24% differential. We think that's important. Specifically, Representative Radinovich mentioned that there are 54 districts that are below $300 per pupil. To put a few more numbers on it, those 54 districts encompass, by our calculations, 58,000 students in Minnesota, and that's 7% of the student body. So what we're asking you here today with this bill is really to help the bottom 7% of the student body in Minnesota get a little bit of funding back into their system. And for kind of a bigger picture on this, the average operating referendum authority in the state right now is, I think, just over $1,000 per pupil. This would allow those districts, those 54, to get up to $300 per pupil, or 30% of the state average. So we're not asking for the moon here, but we're asking for a small step forward to getting some base funding back to those districts. Mr. Chairman and members, I've got some notes from a lot of school districts who would benefit from this about what they would do with these dollars. You know, just quickly, adding courses, maintaining courses, trying to reduce class sizes, adding high school vocational classes and equipment. You know, these are things that in the past we might have considered to be extras that would be approved by operating referendum. But I think when you're talking about trying to create the world's best workforce, looking at those vocational, those high school extracurricular elective courses really aren't extras anymore. They're the types of things we want to have offered to our students. And we see a lot of districts who are able to offer those, but we're talking about 54 school districts, 58,000 students, 7% of the student body who are really struggling to be able to pull that up. This bill goes a long way in making that possible for them. Mr. Chairman and members, and with the time of the essence here, I'd like to move on to, but I'm available for questions.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Siglin Dial, and I'm a freshman at Cambridge Isani High School. I live in the North Branch School District, and I was transferred to Cambridge when North Branch shifted to 4-day school week. I'm intended to attend a college when I graduate. North Branch's cut on a full day of school made me think that I wouldn't be prepared for college if I stayed at North Branch. I've been very frustrated to find that some of these concerns are now evident in Cambridge as well as North Branch and throughout Minnesota. Most of the programs I'm interested in and most likely will pursue in the future, they're limited. Programs like school-funded orchestra, arts program that's limited to one's abilities, a foreign language that covers most of the growing languages this world's experiencing. I feel stuck, and I worry that many of the other schools are experiencing these same challenges. I experience the impacts of these challenges every day when I walk into the school. I'm here to stay as a student. It's important that we do everything we can to help our schools and my peers. My teachers are great. The school wants to be the best it can be to me and my fellow student body. We want to learn. We are facing some challenges that won't let us move forward like we want to. One thing that bothers me most is seeing kids that go to other schools and effortlessly have all the things that I'm looking for, plus more. And like, how would you feel if you or your child were limited to proper education? It's just unfair. Education should be limitless, and this bill is one way to help equalize the funding differences that separate the fortunate schools from the less fortunate ones. I feel every student in Minnesota matters, no matter where they live. So please pass this bill so districts like mine can do better.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for giving a firsthand experience as a student on how the lack of funding impacts you. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome.
Next, please.
Good morning, and thank you for... Thank you for letting us speak today. My name is Robin Dial, and I'm Siglin's mother. And I am from East Central Minnesota area in the North Branch School District. My family had to make a hard choice for my daughters. As Siglin said, we moved them to a neighboring school district. This district too is having financial problems, but there is a slight advantage to it being a district with a 5-day school week. This was not an easy decision for us. I support my community, and transferring my children to another district was done out of our concern. I want the best for my children. If our kids are to be competitive in this world, then they need an education system that supports them. We just can't take any more cuts in teachers, staff, and programs that affect the overall learning experience for our children. They deserve better. This bill could help resolve these problems for communities like ours. We know there is a price to pay for education. I see my neighbors facing off against each other every time our district tries to get a school funding levy passed. I understand how they feel. We are struggling to keep paying our mortgages, and then someone asks us for more money. It's not easy, but these levies need to be done to support our schools and communities. I'm willing to pay to support our schools. I would much rather see our schools being properly supported by a levy than our kids and schools continuing to hurt. The alternatives are simply unacceptable for our entire community. This bill would help solve that problem for many communities and schools across the state. This is a needed step for those districts that are hurting the most. Please, think of families like mine and support this bill.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dial. Thank you. Any other testifiers, Representative Radenovich?
I think maybe there's a few here from other groups.
Thank you.
Very, very brief.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lori Grivna, and I'm speaking on behalf today of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. House File 1406 is a complement to Representative Benson's House File 383, the bill on location equity index that was heard last Thursday in committee and as recommended by the Education Finance Working Group. AMSD does need to go on record, though, and oppose the referendum freeze that's in this bill for calendar year 2013 as a matter of local control for local taxpayers to provide the needed additional funding for their schools. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lundell?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell from Schools for Equity and Education, here today to give our support to Senate File 1406. There's obviously the referendum freeze is troubling to some members, but I think the larger issue here is the issue of closing the gap. I work with the North Branch and Cambridge school districts and understand very on a firsthand basis the difficulties those districts are having in passing referenda. I would just kind of go on record from seeing from my personal perspective is that no district in the state of Minnesota should have to pass a referendum to provide the services that they need for their children. We've become on a system that has become increasingly reliant on the referendum. We need to look at macro and major reform that is going to provide the kind of services that districts need across the state. You know, that's an editorial comment on my half. I don't want to take away from the thunder of Representative Radenovich, but I think House File 1406 is certainly worthy of your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just confused by the 68% increase on the fiscal note between fiscal year 15 and 16, if that could be explained. And then the other LEs I would state was that this appears to allow a school board to increase by $300 without voter approval.
Who wants
Mr.
to?
Mr. Strom probably, I think, would be.
Mr. Strom, can you ask at least the first question as to the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, members, the fiscal note is complicated by the referendum freeze and the behavioral effects. A lot of it is shiftable levy. It's shift impact that explains a lot of the difference there related to the year that the freeze goes into play. And I'll talk to Representative Quam afterwards, but it's a lot of shift effect on in terms of the difference between fiscal 15 and 16 and the total revenue. In terms of the printout revenue, if one assumed no behavioral effect and essentially just gave the $300 to those with less than $300 of referendum, that's where the number on the printouts tells you that effect. But the large fiscal note in many ways reflects a behavioral effect resulted to what would happen to replace referendums if referendums were offset and a freeze.
And then the second question is this allowing a $300 referendum increase without a voter approval? Was that your question, Representative?
Correct, and it apparently would be on all property, so that farmland that isn't normally included in would be, so that That's the two things?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Quam. Danovich.
Yeah, you know, in the Senate file, I think Senator Skoy was the author. They moved from ANTC rates to RMV on the collection of the levy or whatever, and so it went to all properties at that point. And in a lot of these districts in northern Minnesota, it increases the ease in which you could raise that $300. I mean, I think at the heart of the problem here is that with the referendum market value and the disparate levels of tax base from district to district, that the problem is the effort with which they have to approach a levy of $300. And so if you go to ANTC rates, it makes it easier to raise that money. I mean, Mr. Strom, is there anything else?
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess mine is a little bit of a follow-up of the question regarding taxpayer approval. Mr. Strom, clearly the oversimplification of this is that you transfer $300 of what required voter approval in levy now makes it possible just for the school districts just to levy that money without voter approval.
Mr. Strom.
Yes, their referendum would go down by the $300 if they have $300 a referendum. So the voter-approved referendum goes down, and then the board, at its discretion, can raise that $300 through an equalized local levy.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hertaus.
Well, my comment on that is just the systemic problem that we've had with education funding. The governor's budget falls pretty short in terms of expanding the K-12 general formula. And so what we're doing here is we have tax-poor, low-tax-capacity districts that have been struggling to maintain equity funding. And the reason for that is because those folks can't afford to pay anymore. They're not approving these levies. So, you know, I think it's kind of moving in the wrong direction. We need to fix the general formula and make sure that we have closing the gap in terms of the equity funding, but to take away the voter's voice in this is, I think, going in the wrong direction.
Thank you. Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I found the testimony by the representative of the Metropolitan Area School Districts rather troubling. And frankly, insensitive to the needs of the state as a whole. And Representative Radinovich, you are to be thanked for your wisdom and for your courage in presenting this bill. But my question for you is, besides the obvious, which is poverty and unemployment, which results in lack of sustainable, manageable tax wealth, are there any other factors in these districts on the map that contribute to the fact that, unlike silk stocking districts, levy referendums are almost impossible to pass?
Mr. Chair.
Before you answer that, Mr. Radinovich, Mr. Strom, I do want, I see you have metro and non-metro. Can you break that out into silk stocking districts also as another thing on the runs there?
I could do that for you.
Yeah, I'm sure you could.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Radinovich.
Representative Anzell, as you can see on the map, there seems to be a concentration of these districts moving northeastern into Minnesota, and I suspect that this, and one of the things that they did in the Senate file was that they also discussed alongside this the seasonal property issue. And so, you know, in my school district, 48% of the district is seasonal property. They don't pay on operating referendums right now. In Pequot Lakes, it's 58%, 60% up in Reamer. I mean, so the problem is that, you know, one of the reasons that these districts have such a tough time accessing their tax base is because when they go to an operating referendum, half of it is off the table. And so it only increases by double the effort that these people have to put into passing their own referendum. Now, I just want to speak very briefly to some of the comments that have been made earlier. You know, I wholeheartedly support a move towards a funding mechanism which, you know, we don't have to rely on voter-approved referendums. I think it's absurd, really. But, I mean, in the absence of that, you know, what we need to do is solve some of these problems for these school districts that have no capacity to pass an operating referendum. And, you know, while we sit here and we deal with this problem for the last 10 years, I mean, these first graders are becoming second graders, these second graders are becoming third graders, and they're going through a generation where they don't have the same opportunities that other students do across the state. And so I think that it's imperative, you know, I'm more than willing to work with the minority, the majority, or anybody else to find a problem to this you know, find a solution rather to this problem. And so I appreciate your comments and yours as well, Representative Hertas.
Anyone that would like to testify for or against House File 1406, and I see we've got a few, I would like a yes or no in about 15 seconds after that, whether or not you support that, if I could, we could do that. We have one more bill we want.
In 15 seconds. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity. Lars Snegsted with Isaiah. Isaiah is a vehicle for people of faith to act together towards racial and economic equity in the state of Minnesota. We believe that children should be at the center of our education policy, children and families such as the Dial family. So I'd just like to lift up their testimony. And I think the central question on the table here is, why should we help these districts that aren't helping themselves? And I think you all know the answer, because it's the children who are paying the price when those districts are being choked of resources because of the increasing reliance on local levies. So we encourage your support for this bill.
Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Jody Boer on behalf of Education Minnesota, and I just want to echo comments that have been made by Representative Radinovich about that we strongly support fixing the funding formula. As you all know, in the absence of that, we'd like to commend him and thank him for his work on this bill. We support his efforts. We don't support the freeze, but we do support the $300, and we thank him for his efforts.
Thank you very much.
Mary Sicconi, Parents United, yes and yes. we do need to get the location equity index. We do need this. We need to fix the formula. Yes.
Thank you so much. Anyone else? Testify for or against 1406. Representative Radinovich, your closing comments?
I just want to say thank you, and I think that my last set of comments basically, you know, illustrated where I'm at on this issue. I sure hope that, you know, we see a solution coming out of this legislative session to some of these problems plaguing districts across Minnesota. I appreciate it, and I renew my motion to include House File 1406 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thanks.
Thank you so much for bringing this forward. Members, we have one more bill, and we have a testifier that's come from quite some way. So we're going to go through this bill quickly, but I would like to have all the testifiers. So Representative Ann Zelk will move House File 658, be laid over for possible inclusion into the omnibus report. And Representative Moline, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
And members, thank you for having me. My first time in front of Education Finance this session. And I do appreciate your willingness to go over a little bit. My testifier came all the way from Two Harbors, so we want to make sure she's able to get home.
Absolutely.
Members, I'm here on House File 658. As you know, the mining companies don't pay a property tax. They pay what's called a taconite production tax. Which is collected similar to that of a property tax and then distributed to our local municipalities and schools. The school formula is mostly used to reduce school district levies. And in 2009, unfortunately, there was an error, and this bill corrects that flaw in the 2009 language that annually redirected and added 5% of the revenue for tax relief to cities and townships within a school district. Right now, the school districts are only getting 95% of their total property tax relief, and so this bill is meant to address that. And with me, I have Kathy Erickson from Arrowhead Regional Computing Consortium to testify on the bill.
Very good. Welcome, Ms. Erickson. Please proceed and introduce yourself.
My name is Kathy Erickson, and I work for the Arrowhead Regional Computing Consortium in Duluth, and I work for 14 of the 15 Taconite Assistance Area School Districts. And to complement what Representative Moline mentioned, this was just an error in some language from Chapter 298 in 2009. And with the attempt to streamline the payment process, one of the payments doesn't stop at the school district, and the Department of Education is not able to use that payment as part of the calculation for property tax relief. And so this bill just corrects that process to include that payment that goes directly to the cities and townships instead of stopping at the school district first. And so it is really just a technical correction on what the bill was like prior to 2009.
Before we have any questions from members, is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against House File 658? Seeing none, are there any questions from members? If not, Representative Moline, any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair and members, just thanks for taking the time today to hear House File 658, and we appreciate your support.
Thank you very much. And Representative Van Zelk renews his motion to lay over House File 658 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you so much. And members, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.